The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last night I gave a talk on doubt. I was here last night and talked about working with doubt, and sometimes that topic, and it did last night, made me reflect on a particular sutta that the Buddha taught with some people who weren't his followers, but who were confused and experiencing perplexity and doubt. And so I thought I'd explore that teaching today, to go over this teaching with you today. It's a pretty famous sutta. It's one that people often talk about, so some of you may have heard it. It's called the Kalama Sutta. And the Kalamas lived in a town that was kind of at a crossroads, a busy crossroads of travelers. And so they often had various teachers from various different religious sects come to teach in their town. And they found that these teachers said lots of different things. And I'll give you a flavor of some of the kinds of teachings they might have heard, because it's recorded in the suttas, kind of other teachings that were around at the time. And so here's a selection. The world is eternal. This alone is true. Anything else is wrong. Another perspective. The world is not eternal. This alone is true. Anything else is wrong. Another teaching. The world is finite. This alone is true. Anything else is wrong. The world is infinite. This alone is true. Anything else is wrong. It goes on like this. Different perspectives directly contradicting each other. And in this, framed in this way, this is what's true. So framed in the perspective of this is truth, I'm stating truth. And so the Kalamas, hearing all these different teachings, you know, it's in a place where there's a lot of variety of teachings. I mean, like here, we got lots of different kinds of teachings in California. It's sometimes hard to figure out what to trust. And the Buddha came to this town, and they, rather than asking him, "What do you teach?" you know, they decided to ask him a question, rather than just coming out and saying, "Well, tell us what you teach," and then kind of being more confused. They decided to ask him a question. They said, "There are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to our town. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to our town, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. It's that this alone is true, anything else is wrong. For us, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth and which speak falsehood." So this is what they present to the Buddha. They basically describe their experience. Hey, we're confused, you know. People come to town and say all these different things. What are you going to tell us, basically? And the Buddha had a kind of an interesting reply. He said, the first thing he said was, "It's fitting for you to be perplexed. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter." And, you know, he's basically acknowledging, yeah, I mean, people coming and telling you these things are true, these guys are wrong, oh, these guys are true, these guys are wrong, that's going to be confusing. And so he has something to say about an exploration here. The first thing he says is a kind of... He gives a list of 10 ways, basically, that we tend to put our faith, or the ways, 10 ways that we tend to solidify beliefs in our culture. And he says, these are basically oral tradition, teaching by lineage. The first section is kind of tradition, you know, tradition, teaching by lineage, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures. So we sometimes tend to take in, you know, kind of what's the tradition say? And this could be, you know, this could be like, you know, just our culture, for instance. I mean, we may not have these kind of beliefs or teachings. You know, the world is finite, the world is infinite, the world is eternal, the world is not eternal. But we do have some beliefs from our culture. I mean, one of the big beliefs we have from our culture is that happiness comes from getting what we want. And we are told this over and over again. So this would be teaching by hearsay, you know, teaching by what is kind of commonly just talked about in the culture. And he says, don't go by tradition. Don't use this as your guide for, essentially, you know, how do we decide what is truth and what is false? The Buddha said, don't go by tradition, don't go by lineage, don't go by hearsay, don't go by, what was the fourth one? Collection of scriptures. And then he goes on to kind of another area where we tend to consolidate our beliefs is by reasoning, by reflecting, by thinking about things. Thinking about what makes sense to us. Often this comes to us through, again, our culture. You know, what has made sense in a culture? What are we taught in a culture? Often about what feels comfortable to us. So what's true and what feels comfortable can begin to get, what feels comfortable can begin to get conflated with what is true or right. And he says also, don't go by his logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reflecting on reasonings, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it. So again, to kind of, he throws some question on the power of our logical, rational, thinking mind to determine truth and falsehood. So he says, don't go by those things either. And the third area he talks about is essentially around a teacher. He said, don't go by the seeming competence of a speaker. So just because it seems like somebody, you know, has a kind of a charisma, right? You know, just because they have charisma doesn't necessarily mean that they're speaking truth. And just because it seems like they're competent and can describe clearly what that may not be a good basis for exploring truth either. Or because you think this person is our teacher. So I think in India at the time, the guru model was a strong model for understanding and learning. And often there was a kind of a, or my sense is anyway, that there was a kind of a, you take what the guru says and you practice with that. You don't question that. You don't question that. So the Buddha's throwing, casting a question onto that one also. So given that he's kind of undermined most of the ways that we tend to find something to believe in, what is it that we perhaps should kind of take refuge in, or what should we trust? What is trustable? What is trustable? This is the question that the Buddha is exploring. So what is trustable? He says these things, while they may not be, I mean, there's an interesting thing. He's not saying, I don't think anyway, what I don't think he's saying, you should dismiss these things. But he says you shouldn't necessarily unreservedly trust them either. That's my understanding of what he said there. And so is there something that we can trust? So the Buddha goes on here. He says, when you know for yourselves, and he has two sections here, so I'll read the two pieces. When you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, unskillful. These things are blamable. These things are censured by the wise. These things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. When you know for yourselves, these things are wholesome. These things are blameless. These things are praised by the wise. These things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should engage in them. So the first thing I want to point out here is that the Buddha answers a completely different question than they asked. Actually, they say, how do we know what's true? And the Buddha doesn't respond here in terms of truth. He responds very practically in terms of, do things lead to harm, suffering? Abandon those things. Do things lead to happiness and welfare, to well-being? Cultivate those. So he's not talking about what's true. He's talking very practically about what creates peace. And to look for ourselves, what is it? To look in our own experience. What leads to harm? What is unwholesome? And what leads to peace and happiness? Now in this section, he doesn't say, you know, throw over all of the wisdom that comes to us. He actually includes these things are censured by the wise for the unwholesome things. These things are praised by the wise for the wholesome. So he also asks us not necessarily to simply go on our own experience, but to kind of also weigh in with what wise people say. So this maybe leads to a little bit of a confusion or a sense of uncertainty, but it's I think the last sentence there around these things lead to harm and suffering is really the place of reflection. And so if people are teaching things that would lead to harm and suffering, we should question that. If people are teaching things that lead to our welfare, our happiness, we should explore that. So he's asking us to explore in our own experience this we should know for ourselves. This know for ourselves is, I think this is an instruction. This is not we should think for ourselves. So he's not talking about thinking about, he's talking about looking in our experience, looking at states of mind, actions that we engage in, and to explore. Does this create harm for myself or another, or for both? Or does it not create harm, not create suffering, not create affliction? In a teaching to his own son, he used this, his son at the age of 7, he used this very reflection on, do your actions before you act, he said, reflect on, is it going to cause harm? Is it going to cause affliction? And if so, don't go there. While you're acting, if it's causing harm, if you see it's causing harm or affliction, stop doing it. After you've acted, if you see it has caused harm, he says, undertake restraint for the future. Don't go there again. That isn't a helpful direction. So the reflection on what causes harm is the core of the Buddha's teaching and the core of his own exploration when he set out to find happiness? His question was actually, what is this suffering? What is this affliction that we experience? And is it possible to be free of it? And so that was his whole motivation for undertaking his path, his practice. And what he says is that that's what we should use as a guide for our behavior, for our engagement with the world, for looking at our experience. And so this when you know for yourselves is about looking at experience in the moment. This is not an easy instruction, this one instruction, when you know for yourselves. This is what we teach here, you know, how does one know for themselves? We explore this tool of mindfulness. This is, this tool, as I was guiding you in the guided meditation, this tool of how can we be present for life as it is lived now? That is the tool that helps us to know for ourselves. And this knowing for ourselves begins to reveal with this. So this knowing for ourselves with this, let's say, joined with this reflection of does this lead to harm? Does this lead to suffering? Or does it lead to ease and peace? That those two together bring it brings a kind of perspective to the mindfulness when we are looking at our experience through this lens of, is it creating harm? Is it creating suffering? So for instance, simply, a simple one might be we begin to recognize actions that we do. You know, saying something harsh to someone, we can see the harm it causes. We can see the pain it causes in another. And so that is an example. You know, in the present moment, we can see. If we're present, we can see what's happening. In our own hearts and minds, a kind of a subtler example might be observing, getting to know a state like anger. You know, when I first started exploring anger, my very first exploration, my first meditation practice in my daily life was to watch anger in my mind. And at some point, I had the really big aha, which it seems like so obvious now when I look at it, but I had this really big aha moment that the way I had been relating to anger before I began turning my attention and saying, well, what is this experience of anger? So this, what does it mean to know anger for myself? What is that experience? Before I began doing that, my whole relationship to anger was something like, well, I sure hope this anger makes that person feel miserable. You know, and completely, you know, focused on the misery of that other person. And, you know, so there, right there, right, that the whole notion of anger was an attempt to inflict suffering on somebody. In retribution, kind of in revenge, basically. You know, I was angry at this person for something they had done to me, and so it's like, well, I sure hope they're miserable with me being angry. You know, it's like, so in observing the anger myself, I began to recognize, and this was like a shock. I mean, I remember where I was when I realized, like, wait a minute, this anger is making me miserable. This doesn't feel good. Anger is not a state that feels pleasant or feels helpful. When I was in the perspective of the thing that I need to do is make that person feel miserable, sure, anger might be helpful to do that, but also it was making me miserable. And I had completely missed that until I turned with this mindfulness to look, what is this experience of anger? And so this practice of when you know for yourselves, it deepens for us. You know, we begin to see certain mind states, certain relational emotions as being harmful both to ourselves and to others. That essentially these kind of reactive mind states create internally a contraction and externally can create harm. So we using that guide as a, or that teaching around does it create harm as a guide begins to help us to understand that certain states of mind tend to lead us towards unhappiness, towards suffering, not only in our own hearts, but in the world, adds to the suffering in the world. And other states tend to move us in another direction. States like generosity or compassion or kindness. Those qualities of heart tend to move us towards well-being, move us towards more happiness. And so the Buddha isn't saying, let's see if we can figure out what's true. He's saying, let's see if we can understand what will make us happier in our experience. So it's not, this is, I think, a really crucial teaching of the Buddha. And his teaching is so pragmatic. It's not so much about proclaiming truth as it is about pointing a way to practice that will guide us towards happiness. And he does make some statements. I mean, sometimes the Buddha was accused of being someone who made no declarative statements. Let's see if I can find this one. Because there's lots of times where, like, if for instance, people came to him and said, what do you teach? Do you teach the world is finite? He wouldn't answer. Do you teach the world is infinite? He wouldn't answer. Do you teach it's eternal? He wouldn't answer. And so people sometimes accused him of being a non-declarer. See if I can find this piece. Shoot, I thought I had it marked. Sorry about this. Well, I will paraphrase since I can't find it. I remember what it said, but I can't find the exact place in there. When he was accused of being someone who didn't declare things, one of his disciples... He was accusing one of his disciples, saying, when I ask the Buddha these questions, he doesn't answer, so he doesn't declare things. And the monk said, the Buddha does declare things. He declares this is wholesome, this is unwholesome. He declares these things are helpful in leading us to happiness. These things are unhelpful in leading us to happiness. These things should be cultivated. These things should not be cultivated. So he declares those things. And yet the encouragement is to practice them, not to just believe. Belief doesn't free us, but to explore this teaching. Right? Okay, these things are unhelpful. What happens if I let go of those? Very quickly in my own experience, as I started turning my attention towards that anger, it's like it began to, the mindfulness itself began to give me some space around it, and it began to release. This was felt very directly as helpful in my experience. A lot more openness of heart, ease of mind, less contraction, less pain. So very directly felt. So when practiced, confirmed very quickly, this direction is helpful. See what else here. So the other thing the Buddha does say, or actually he asks, he's interesting here in this particular case. He seems to understand that the Kalamas have a general sense of ethics, a general sense of what does lead to harm and what does lead to happiness. And he asks them, what do you think? When greed, hatred, and delusion arise, is it for one's welfare or harm? And they say, for his harm. The Buddha says, a person who is greedy, hating, and deluded, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, thoughts controlled by greed, hatred, and delusion, will destroy life, take what is not given, engage in sexual misconduct, and tell lies, and will also prompt others to do likewise. Will that conduce to his harm and suffering? And they say, yes. So he, in this case, rather than just saying, look, these states, these are unwholesome, he actually queries them, does this make sense to you? Is this what you believe, that acting out of greed, acting out of aversion, acting out of delusion will be harmful? And they agree, yes, that's harmful. That leads to suffering. That leads to unhappiness. And so he says, don't practice those. Find ways to release, to let go of those. And very much the so much of our practice, so this is, the word is abandon. These things should be abandoned. So states based in greed, aversion, and delusion should be abandoned. And that word abandoned, sometimes our association with that word has some negative connotations. Like we think of abandoning something we're supposed to be taking care of, like abandoning a child. But I think another way, perhaps the way that this word is being used here, is that another time, another way that we abandon something is when we understand it's no longer valuable for us. It's no longer helpful for us. It's no longer useful. Very naturally, when we understand that something is not useful, we begin to let go of it. You know, if you have something that no longer functions or no longer works, and there's no way to fix it, you know, it's like, well, I can just, you know, we just kind of we abandon it. It's like it's not useful to us anymore. So the exploration around these states of mind is that with the mindfulness, we begin to explore and we begin to understand that they're not so useful. So the example around anger, you know, very directly in my experience, that aha moment around, wow, this creates suffering here. I hadn't noticed that. You know, I hadn't recognized that. It's like, wow, this is not helpful. This is not useful. So the mind began to understand very directly, this was not a helpful thing. And that was the beginning of the letting go, the beginning of the abandoning of that anger. I'm not saying that just seeing that once made it like, oh yes, I cannot be angry anymore. Over and over again, we need to make this practice, knowing for ourselves what's helpful, what's not helpful. In the teaching of the Buddha, the instruction, I think, is pointing to familiarity with the experience. And then, as he pointed to his son, not acting when we see it would cause harm. So experiencing the state of anger, but not acting out of it. Not repressing it either, because repressing also is bringing a kind of an aversion to the picture. So there's a kind of an interesting middle path the Buddha's asking us to walk, you know, to in this knowing for ourselves, to neither repress nor express, but to meet, to be with. The mindfulness begins to educate us about what is helpful and what is not helpful. There are times when we do have to there are times when we do have to say no to our minds. To say, don't go there. You know, that's not helpful. Sometimes when, if there's a really strong pull to something that we see is going to cause harm, either to ourselves or another, if there's a really strong pull in that direction and we see the damage that's going to come from that or the harm that's going to come from that, sometimes there can be a place for a strong, no, don't do that, don't go there, that comes from compassion, comes from a sense of the more harm that would be created by going there. So one example of this, one of my friends on one long retreat had been really seeing her mind pull into a very strong, unwholesome mind state, a very habitual mind state for her, one that had been conditioned through her life. And she really deeply saw how sticky it was and how hard it was to get out of once her mind got there. And she got to the place on this retreat where she could see just the beginning, kind of the heading down that slippery slope, going in that direction. And as she could see that, she began to feel this this welling up of, no, don't go there, just don't go there. So that it was kind of a strong, no around that. There may have been some aversion there. There may have been some aversion there. What I'd like to propose, perhaps, is that the aversion to the state where she would have gone was a less unwholesome place than the state. And sometimes that's the way we move in our practice. That another example in my own practice, I'm really now really starting to see a way that my mind is kind of clinging to or greedy about investigating. Now this investigation, this capacity for investigation, it served me in my practice very well. Investigating anger, the greed that's around the investigation is a much less sticky or much less unwholesome state than the anger. And so in fact, I didn't particularly experience that investigation. I didn't experience the greed around the investigation for a long time. So I wasn't experiencing the suffering of that investigation until the larger kinds of sufferings that I was investigating, the greed, the depression, the anger, the confusion, all of that, as those started to get much, much less, the mind is kind of in the space of, well, what can I investigate now? What can I investigate now? What can I look at? And it's like, whoa, that's wanting. And beginning to feel the pain of that wanting. So the practice very naturally begins to point us to where we're holding, what it is that we're holding to that's creating suffering. Using this tool of what is creating harm and suffering, knowing for ourselves what's creating harm and suffering, not in the mind, like for instance, if I had begun by saying, oh, investigation, there's greed in investigation, I shouldn't be greedy, so I shouldn't investigate, I wouldn't have gotten very far in my practice at the beginning. If I had the idea, if I was holding some idea of, oh, all greed is bad and I shouldn't do anything that has greed and there must be greed in that investigation, I wouldn't have gotten very far. So I often encourage using suffering, using affliction as a guide for us, you know, as the Buddha recommended to his son. If there is harm, if there's suffering in oneself, in others, that's a place to investigate. That's a place to explore. Towards the end of this, there's one other piece here. The Buddha, after talking about abandoning, letting go of the unwholesome states and cultivating the wholesome states, he says that when one is devoid of covetousness, devoid of ill will, one is unconfused, clearly comprehending, ever mindful. That's a high bar, I have to say. But what he's pointing to, I think, is that with this practice of exploring what's helpful, what's not helpful, it begins to cultivate these tools. It begins to cultivate our capacity for mindfulness. It begins to keep us more present. We begin to understand what's helpful, what's not helpful. We clearly comprehend what will be for our happiness. And so very naturally, he says, when one understands that, one begins to dwell in beautiful mind states. One begins to dwell in loving kindness, in compassion, in joy, in equanimity. So these are states of mind that part of what I think he's pointing to. It's not completely clear here, but it seems to me that the direction that he's saying is that when we know for ourselves, when we understand what's unhelpful and have abandoned it, when we understand what's helpful and have begun the cultivation of that, that very naturally the mind that has been released from greed, aversion, and confusion is naturally open-hearted, naturally experiences love, compassion, joy, and balance of mind. And so he's pointing to, I think, he often talks about the hindrances, the states of mind that confuse us, that create struggle, suffering in our hearts and in our minds. He often talks about them as visitors. There's one place where the Buddha says, the mind is luminous, but it is obscured by visiting. The word he uses is stains or defilements. It's obscured. The luminosity, the purity, the clarity of the mind is obscured by visiting defilements. And so this is what I think he's pointing to here, that as those stains, as the mind lets go of the habitual ways that we're reactive, it begins to more naturally open to what's here, which is love, compassion. And then he goes on to make some assurances to somebody who has practiced like this. And again, it's about the practice. It's not about belief. But he's pointing here to beliefs. In a way, he says, I'll just read the first two of these assurances. He says, the first assurance he has won is this. If there's another world, if good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results, it is possible with the breakup of the body after death, I shall arise in a good destination. So basically, you know, that given this approach of, it's not about belief, but about acting from a place of refraining from things, actions, mind states that take us to suffering, that create more harm in the world. Then he says, if there is another world, I mean, if there is, if that's true, if there's truth in that statement, then your destination will be a happy one. If there's truth to that statement that there's that good and bad deeds bear fruit and yield results. Then he says, the second assurance is, if there is no other world, so, you know, this the other side of it, you know, pointing back to this these different perspectives that people came with, just contradictory, well, it's this way. No, it's not that way. That's completely wrong. It's this way. And the Buddha is saying that on both sides here, the practice yields good fruit. So in the second one, the second assurance is, if there is no other world, if good and bad deeds do not bear fruit and yield results, right here in this very life, I live happily, free of enmity and ill will. And so he's basically, there's another sutta where he says, you've made you've made a lucky wager on whatever bet there is. And so again, he's pointing to, it's not so much about the belief, but about this engagement, this practice of exploring what takes us towards happiness, what helps us to reduce suffering in our own hearts and in the world. So, questions, comments, thoughts?
So there's a complexity here about after one recognizes the wholesome state and wanting to let go or explore or investigate anger. But there's also a clinging to a lifelong pattern that somehow brought satisfaction. I'll use that word because it there is a payoff for holding on, or people who recognize the unwholesomeness of it, and et cetera. So this complexity of investigation into why do I cling to this unwholesome state? The mind says it's unwholesome. Say no at the same time that it's sort of like the brakes, you know, and yet there
and
is
then
this,
there's this whole history of habit that says, say yes.
Yes, that's exactly. So the investigation feels more complex to a lifelong pattern.
It is. It's absolutely more complex. I mean, you feel into the, and that's what I was pointing to around sometimes we have to say no, and there may be a sense of, you know, a little aversion there. In the saying of no, but that seeing the result, knowing the result to be unwholesome, that the saying no is perhaps a little bit less unwholesome than the outcome itself. Now, the other place, though, that we explore, and the more complexity of the exploration, is that we also see, I mean, that one of the insights we begin to see that the whole pattern, and let's talk about it around wanting, because that's, I think, the easiest place to explore this particular thing is that, you know, all of our lives we have found, and this very strong momentum in this direction, very strong, we've practiced it over and over again, and we've gotten feedback over and over again that when I get what I want, I'm happy. You know, it starts from the time we're a child. You know, we see some toy that we want, we get it, we feel happy. Some kid takes it away from us, we're miserable. You know, it's like, so the notion that having what I want brings happiness is very well ingrained in our minds. And we see that over and over again. You know, we feel miserable when we don't get the job that we want, when a relationship ends. You know, it's like we see over and over again that when I do get what I want, oh, that person, that's the right person for me. We have this, yes, that's it. You know, we have that happiness. Over and over again, we get that feedback. So it cements that habit. So it's very strong yes in that direction. And so the exploration that we make here is to begin to explore, you know, that wanting has a delusion in it. The delusion of wanting is that get that thing and you'll be happy. So the wanting is telling us that happiness will come from having that thing. There's the wanting itself, which is a pull towards the thing, but the delusion that's underlying it is that's where happiness will be found. And the delusion of wanting, or so wanting, that state of mind of wanting, is not going to tell you that if the wanting goes away, happiness will follow. So this is one of the things that we start to see as we explore the state of wanting itself. First of all, you know, with wanting, we are usually so focused on the thing and the idea and the fantasy. I mean, it's like our minds very quickly will create a world in which we have that thing and feel happy having that thing. That's all completely constructed in our minds. So, you know, this is what our minds do. You know, we want something, and it creates this vision of this is what it will be like to have it. Have it. And that vision, that idea is pleasant. So we feel good having that idea. We feel good having that wanting. But what that is masking is that the feeling of wanting itself is unpleasant. The construction of that little future of this is what it will be like to have what I want is masking from us that the state of wanting itself already, as soon as wanting springs up, there's a feeling that something's off, that something's wrong. We do not usually see or experience that feeling of something off because we're in that world. We don't experience the suffering around wanting often until we don't get what we want. Then we feel the pain of that. With the mindfulness, and this is part of the subtlety and the complexity of exploring it, we're asked to turn towards what does it feel like to want something? What is the experience of wanting itself? Letting ourselves come out of the fantasy and turn towards the experience itself, and we begin to see in our direct experience, wow, that wanting doesn't feel good. Now, that experience of wanting doesn't feel good is usually not enough to keep us from wanting, because what we do is when we get what we want, the wanting goes away. You know, so that's another reason why wanting and having is so potent, because when we do get what we want, the unpleasantness of wanting goes away. And I would like to propose to you, from a good deal of my own exploration in this, that the majority of the pleasant that comes when we get what we want is that the wanting goes away. The feeling of that, there's a hole, there's something that needs to be filled. That feeling goes away. And for just a few moments, it's like everything's right with the world. The feeling of the wanting ending is mainly where happiness comes from getting what we want. That piece of information doesn't yield itself to our ordinary minds very easily. We need to turn and look at our experience to see that. And if you can have the exploration, and for myself, this is where this understanding came, is the willingness to watch wanting without following through on it, to explore the experience itself of wanting to look at someone, wanting to have a piece of chocolate, whatever, it could be small, Explore a small wanting. Feel into the pull there. You may or may not actually see the wanting end, but you may at some point actually get to watch that. For myself, that seeing of wanting ending was a huge aha moment. Because when I saw, I was one of the most powerful times around this was doing walking meditation. And I was really wanting to look at people who were walking nearby. And so just exploring that wanting, not following through, but just feeling the pull and feeling how strong it got, the more it would be easy to just like look up, you know. I wouldn't have to even turn my head, you know. It's just like all I have to do is raise my eyes. You know, the stronger the pull got, the stronger the feeling of, ugh, I really want to look. It's like this magnet. Somebody called it a tractor beam at one point. You know, it's like the Star Trek. Star Trek? Is it Star Trek tractor beam? You know, it's like it latches on. So that's the way it felt, you know, this pull. And I could feel that. I didn't follow through on it. I just kept my gaze down, but felt into that and watched it get, like, as soon as somebody would appear in my field of vision, it would begin. There was no wanting until somebody appeared into my field of vision. And then it got stronger and stronger as they got to a place where it would be easier and easier. Then they're like walking right in front of me. It's like, oh, really want to look. And then they would like walk up the stairs and go into a door. The wanting vanished. And in that moment, it felt like I was released from a vice grip. The release of that wanting was so powerful. Just a simple wanting, like wanting to look at somebody. The wisdom, the insight that came from watching that was broader than just that situation, but really to see wanting is the is a lot of the suffering. It's the wanting itself will let go. It's not about having the thing. The having the thing is just like scratching an itch, you know? It just makes me want to want more. So it is a complex exploration. And keep exploring. So many little ways, I mean, little things can yield great fruit. Little explorations around, you know, completely non-threatening things. I mean, it's not like you have to, like, sit there and observe the wanting around, oh, I need to get a job. Oh, I should just watch the wanting around getting a job. And, you know, no, you need to act and get the job. I mean, and potentially look at what you can around that. You know, look at the wanting around that you can. But, you know, it's some of these small areas of wanting observation, little ways in which we suffer can really teach the mind so much. And it's time to stop. So, thank you.